When I was at BlackRock, I got promoted for a job a bit early, and I was up against another girl for it.
Mm.
And she told everyone that me and my boss were sleeping together.
That's messy.
Oh,
that is so messy.
I was like, how old was I? I was 25. It felt like my world was like crashing.
Over.
That was a moment where I was like, that is rough. Like, I would have thought we would have been supporting each other.
You know, they say women shouldn't be bossy.
We're out here reclaiming that word. What's so wrong with being the boss? Bossy.
Welcome back to Bossy. I'm actually really, really excited for this episode because we have my friend Lindsay Dorf here to talk about, well, we're going to talk kind of about like flops and just the trials and tribulations of business and the way Tara talks about it, that entrepreneurial boxing match
that we
stay in.
The roller coaster. Yeah.
Yes. So we're going to talk about that today. And as always, we don't want it to be just like us peppering Lindsay with questions, but just a group discussion and kind of adding her as a third co-host to the mix. So I want to give a little background intro on Linz because she's like one of the most impressive people I know, frankly. She's like ex-BlackRock, ex-Google, Harvard Business School, just like you name institutional prestige, and there's like a check mark next to Lindsay's name, which is just like the complete
complete
opposite of my journey. But
it's giving badass.
She's a badass. She really is, and she's just like a very graceful founder. So I am an advisor for her company Aster Money, and it's kind of the first time that I've got to have that like up close and personal watching someone build something zero to one, and just the way you navigate all the challenges of it. Like, you are so, you never seem like you get like rankled ever. You're just very.
I definitely do.
Well, I've never seen it. I've never witnessed it, even amidst like the really kind of crazy, tough, stressful elements of it. Cause I mean, that's like what it is half the time. So, I mean, I have a lot of things that I would like to talk about, fundraising, like hiring, how you're getting talent, like just things that are stressing you out right now. But in general, I think it'll be a fun convo just to talk about like when things go wrong and how we deal.
Yeah. So there's this thing on social media that's like there's a lot of popularity around this. It's called like a Canaan event.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Canaan event. I haven't seen this.
Okay. So essentially, it's just like a really bad thing. I think I'm saying it right. Canaan event. A really bad thing that happens in your life. Like someone like passes away. You lose a job. Like there's like a whole catastrophic thing that happens. And it changes kind of the course of your life. But you kind of have to go through it to get to the other side. I think probably there's a couple of them in my own life, like definitely getting laid off for my job at Microsoft, which felt like such a like terrible thing at the time, which now I'm like, thank goodness, because I like learned so much from that process. I'm curious if you can think of like some of those points for yourself.
Yeah. I mean, personally and professionally, I'd say they're different.
Yeah.
From a professional perspective, I mean, almost every week, I think you have one of these moments where
the many moments
where something happens that you didn't expect and you just have to figure out how to navigate it. I think the hardest one for us over the past year was probably going through fundraising. So we had, well, I started this company and I'll share a little bit more about Aster.
Yes, I would love to do that.
But I had started this company in business school. So I was getting a joint business degree and an engineering degree.
Yeah.
And we had different competitions in school where you could fundraise.
Yeah.
And so we had gotten about 200K to get the business off the ground.
Great.
And then we hire an engineering team. We start building. We reach a point where we think we're ready to raise our seed round. We have a product that's going out the door. We have about 100 test users. The
metrics
are looking
good.
It had taken about a year.
A year, okay.
From ideation to raising the funds to getting the team to getting like an initial alpha out the door.
Great.
We go to market to raise our seed round and we realize like the market we thought it was is not the market anymore. This was in May of 2023.
Oh, yes. Mm.
So the market was changing a ton. We're building in consumer fintech.
Yeah.
So it was a hard place to be building in.
What was the market before and what was the market now? Like for people who are maybe not in the fundraising process or like in tech or in this space, what was the shift?
Well, so I'll explain what we were walking into. To raise a seed round, they said you need to have 20,000 users that are like actively using your product. And that's your seed round.
Yeah.
And
before it was like do you have an idea on a Google Doc?
Exactly.
Amazing. We are out. $5 million.
Totally. We're out of that phase though now. Like so many people think like, oh, I can
so
raise
much.
Money. Yeah, it's not. We're not there. Okay, so you walk into this different market.
So we walk into this different market, which in hindsight, I should have done a bit more research the months leading up to it. Like every month you need to be on top of like, what is the market changing into and what are you looking at? But we go into fundraising and I'm trying to raise between like $2 and $4 million. So this isn't like a big seed round. This is like an average or maybe even smaller seed round. And we have in May, maybe 40 meetings.
Yeah.
You get so many no's. So many.
Mm-hmm.
And when you're interviewing for a job, you're not doing 40 interviews.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we are just not used to, like, getting 40 no's in a month.
Yeah. So then humans are not, you don't
know. No, I mean, even when
that.
You're, like, dating, it reminded me so much of dating. Like, sometimes you get ghosted. There's just so many pieces that are parallels. But,
And then they say maybe and kind of drag you on. And you're like, is it maybe or is it no? I don't really know. But maybe it is maybe. So you like, think
exactly.
you need to follow up. But it's
and
a no.
And this is where it reminds you of dating. Because it's like you sometimes get to know the other person, the investors. You're like, wow, we clicked. We had like some magic. And then you get that like a long email, you know, after four meetings that is like, we're just not yet, you know.
Four meetings.
So
yeah.
I think going through fundraising and getting those no's initially and being like, in order for this business to survive, like, we need money.
Mm-hmm.
And at the point where you, like, have this initial alpha product, there's so much that you need to figure out on how to convince someone. Because it's not like you have all of these crazy metrics and, like, all this crazy growth. Like, figuring out how to get acquire customers when you don't want to spend money on it is hard.
Yeah.
And so I would say for us, or for me, the hardest moment was handling those no's and being like, all right, how do these no's help us look at the product differently and figure out what we need to change and how do we use these conversations as research? Because every person I'm talking to is or knows this market super well. So how do I use this to help the business? How do I use this to make us stronger instead of like coming home and being like, I just got rejected yet again.
Yeah. Can you, before you go up, jump into like the rejection of it all, because I do want to talk about
I have a couple follow-ups.
Can
too.
You just quickly just catch everybody up on what Aster Money is and how
yes,
the product, like just
please.
Give us that context so we're really clear on that. Yeah.
So we are building a personal finance platform for women, which is why Katie is one of our amazing advisors. And the way that we do it is our core focus is to grow confidence investing, which was a massive problem we saw. I think the metric was like 90% of people we spoke to said, I want to be more confident investing.
Mm.
And what we found is people are most confident investing when they know what people similar to them are doing with their money.
Okay.
So when they know different investment strategies, they're like, okay, I've seen this person, you know, buying single name equities or purchasing these ETFs or using this robo advisor. Like, these are the strategies. This is what works. And this is what I'm choosing for myself.
Mm.
And a lot of these more social investing platforms are very focused today on what's the next GameStop? Like, what's that one stock I want to buy? And instead, we wanted it to be more of like, how do I benchmark myself to people similar to me?
Mm-hmm.
How do I get like a really good understanding of what I'm doing? Like, what is my return? What is my allocation? What is my risk? And how do I compare that to someone who has a similar income, similar net worth, similar life scenario to me to see what's working and what isn't? And so we weave in this social piece in a very approachable way.
Got it. Okay, that makes a lot of sense.
I was going to ask if that why was part of the fuel that helped pull you through all the no's, kind of your deep belief in the product and in the need for it.
Definitely. I mean, you are in that moment and so many very smart people are saying to you like, no, like I don't believe you can acquire customers cheaply or like there's so many people who have tried and failed. Like what makes you different? And you really need to believe that there is a problem here that you can figure out how to solve and that you're the right person to be doing it. But yeah, I mean, in that moment you have, and I'm sure you felt the same, like you have a ton of moments where you're like, can we do this?
Yeah.
Like, can we solve this problem? And you have to really want to solve the problem and feel like it's your job to be solving it, to like power through in those moments.
The other thing too with investors is it's not just like you have to realize too that it's not them saying, I don't think that you can do it.
Totally.
It's more so that, like, first of all, it's not even their money. They have investors of their fund, usually, unless you're talking only to angel investors. Were you talking only to angels or, like, funds?
We were actually only talking to funds.
To funds. Okay. Yeah. So with a fund, that dude that you're talking to, it ain't his money, right? Mm-hmm. Somebody else gave him money. And it is his job to make himself look good with what he did with that money. And he has a bunch of people come, and I'm saying he because, like, it's very often a dude.
Unfortunately, yes.
What percent?
Yeah, do you know, have you ever, like, sat down and been like, man, it was...
I don't know the exact percent. I want to say, I don't know. I read it recently that I think it's, like, less than 7% of VCs are female.
Yeah, I mean, just of your meetings that you had.
Oh, for our meetings?
Yeah, for your meetings.
Do you remember any women?
So I would say about 80% of our meetings were with male VCs.
Yeah, yeah.
I would say we met some incredible female VCs, but the only investors that we have right now that are actual funds, so we have one or two female angels, but all of our VCs are male right now. Like, our lead investor, who is incredible and believes in our mission, was at our event last night, is male.
I just want to say sometimes it's harder to get the women on board.
I think so.
Outside of angel investors, like, once you're in, like, I have found this from investors and also just, like, job interviews. Like, my experience when I would go to a job interview was, like, if there was a black woman, for example, on the other side of the interview interviewing me, I'd be like, oh, I'm definitely not getting it.
Why?
Really?
What do you say?
Just because
for?
I think you have, like, that person works at a company where they're probably the only one or a few of the only one. They're the only woman, the only person of color. So they've, like, you're a reflection on them. And so they got to be extra, extra, like, toughness dialed up, and they're really looking at, like, I think it just is sort of a thing that happens, but I think sometimes, like, at least in my experience, my biggest allies in business and people have helped me lean towards being men over women, and it's, like, an unfortunate.
I will say it's the same for me.
Yeah,
the worst things that have happened to me in the workplace have happened from women.
Wow. And the dudes, what, like, the ones that are good, they will really champion me. They'll be like, hey, thank you for inviting me to the panel, but, like, I don't see this being a very diverse panel. Like, here are some people to call, and if you get them on board, one of these people on board, then I'll also come. Like, women are less likely to do that.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some studies around how, like, when you feel like you are wearing that role and there can only be one woman there, then you feel like there's more competition against the other women. And so it's important for all of us to look at that and say, like, we're not going to fall into that. There can be so many of us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's the there can only be one phenomenon, which you see that in a lot of marginalized groups, I think, which is exactly how you've described this competition, or, like, being accepted, E-X-C, accepted versus accepted, A-C-C, accepted. Yes. It's like... That's really interesting, though. That's like, frankly, kind of, like, disappointing to hear. Like, I'm, like, having a moment where I'm, like, that really makes me sad.
I have had some amazing female mentors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We're probably going totally off topic here. But when I was at BlackRock, I got promoted for a job a bit early. And I was up against another girl for it.
Mm.
And she told everyone that me and my boss were sleeping together.
Holy smokes.
It was, like, my first promotion, like, kind of, like, out of line, out of, like, the normal promotions. And
that's messy.
Oh,
that is so messy.
And I was, like, how old was I? I was 25. It felt like my world was, like, crashing.
Over.
Yeah. I will say BlackRock did a phenomenal job handling it.
Wow.
Phenomenal. Made me, like, really proud to be at that company. But, yeah, that was a moment where I was, like, that is rough.
That
I would
not
have thought this happened from, like, I would have thought we would have been supporting each other.
You would think. That could have been another, like, business flop, workplace flop experience. And it sounds like it didn't. You got saved, maybe, from that one.
I did. And it was, I think it was a, I will speak very highly of BlackRock. I will speak very highly of my manager.
Yeah.
Because he did not, you know, shy away from teaching me more and, like, spending time mentoring me. Yeah. Which I think was my biggest fear in that moment. I was like, now that this is going around, am I going to be kind of like exiled? Mm. And he really helped me, and he was the one who really brought me into product. So yeah. The company handled it well.
I have one other remaining question, though, about fundraising, which I think is interesting, because I can imagine someone listening to this and going, okay, I'm about to go into a round of fundraising. Like Lindsay said, that I should be researching every month, like what's going on in this market. What are you reading to do that research? Who are you talking to? Like, what does that process look like for you?
That's a great question.
I think the biggest thing is you have to talk to people in your network.
Talk to people in your network. Yes, okay.
And read. There's a ton of great newsletters. For me, the biggest thing is finding people who work in the space and being like, all right, to raise a seed round, what do I need now? Is it still 20,000 users? Do I need like X million dollars in revenue? Mm-hmm. Like, what is it that I need? And just talking to people, I would say, is the best way to do it.
Okay. There's so much in business and entrepreneurship that there is no published report on. You are not going to find it. It ain't there. And like even people aren't talking publicly about it. You have to like get in a room and just like one-on-one, like tell me a little bit. Like you have to ask poking questions to like get to the
totally
real.
Suss out the hot gossip.
Yeah.
About what's going down.
Yeah, 100%.
Yeah. I also think part of it is, as much as we can say like, all right, there are these metrics that like you are expected to hit, there are always outliers. Always. Yeah. So there's, you know, certain people who can walk into a meeting and like exude this crazy confidence when there's not even a product out. And there's other people mm-hmm. like myself where I can really believe in the mission and really believe in the product and know we're going to get there. But exuding that type of confidence that someone else might be able to without, you know, having it in front of me is just harder.
Yeah.
And so much of it is personality. So much of it is bias. So much of it is metrics, of course. But early stage, you know, I think it's the whole package.
Mainly not metrics. I actually think early stage investing is mainly
vibes.
Can you make that person wish that they were you when you like when they were your age? If they can live a little bit vicariously through you, that's what you're selling, actually.
You think?
Yeah. Do you like, are you like, do you make them cool? Like so much of it is like cool currency. We invested in the cool company. Like so much of investing is social game. We want to invest in something that's cool. It's going to make us look good. And also like, oh yeah, like I want to like, cause you know, that person oftentimes was like goofy and nerdy in school. And so like, are you cool? Like so much of that, like when you see the people who win in fundraising, they're able to like deliver this vicarious thing. But I wanted to ask you about this like flop that you were talking about like your Canaan event or maybe one of them. Because I'm curious about how you handled it. And the reason I'm thinking about this, just to tell you a quick story about this. So my boyfriend sold his first company. He's actually sold a couple companies, but he sold a company that was like a big sale for him, and he sold it to SC Johnson.
Mm-hmm.
And when I met him, he was telling this story as a failure story. Like he was like...
How so?
Right, right. He was like, you know, because he didn't get the like, the exact payout that he wanted. Mm-hmm. And so, and there was sort of a lot of like drama that sort of happened around it. Like we know that like when this, these sorts of deals happen, there's a lot of stuff that happens. Right. And one day I was like, why do you tell this story? Like it's a flop story. Mm-hmm. Like when I hear this story, it sounds like a win, a dub. You sold your company to SC Johnson, like a Fortune 500 company. Like, why do you keep telling it this way? And I think he has this strong moral obligation in general in life. And so I think he feels like obligated to say, like when it's not all rainbows, to like say it directly. Yeah. Right. Which I understand. But I also understand that like every win, every flop story has a win on the other side of it. Like there's no only flop story, but you could choose to see it that way.
Yeah.
So I'm curious for you about when you think about your own flops, like how, what do you do afterwards to sort of like lick your wounds? And also, do you eventually see it as a win and a flop, or does it always just exist as a flop in your head?
One of my like life philosophies, which has helped me to date, I don't know if it will help me forever, is that things happen for a reason.
Yeah.
So as we were going through those meetings and not getting like the initial yeses that we wanted, it did help us go back to the drawing board and say, you know, there are things we are learning in these meetings and things they are pointing out that like we need to dive into a bit more.
Mm-hmm.
And so we took some time to dive in and ended up pivoting our product to focus a bit more on women. So a lot of, you know, finally making that decision did come from a lot of, you know, the conversations we had.
Yeah.
So for me, I think one of the things we have to keep doing when we're starting companies, any type of company, is reflecting. Like, we get caught so often in this wheel of, like, I'm behind, then I'm working too late, and then I'm falling behind on everything else in life, and then the next day starts and we're not, like, stepping back and actually reflecting on what is the problem we're solving, are we solving it the right way, and, like, how do we get there in the most efficient way.
Yeah.
And so for me, taking that time, we ended up taking, like, 2 weeks after May to, like, repivot, relook at the research, think about these conversations.
Did you cry first?
Did I cry? Oh my gosh, if you asked my boyfriend, I think I cried like once a week, honestly. But I'm also a crier. Like, I love to cry.
I am too.
What's your sign?
I'm a Virgo.
Okay.
So is my husband.
Yeah.
What's your sign, Katie?
Capricorn.
You're a Capricorn. I'm a Cancer. I'm a crier.
Ooh. So we're all criers.
Regularly.
We're all criers. We should cry together. That should be a segment of this show, is just weeping. This is the weeping segment that we've entered. I'm curious, you know, you mentioned, I think it's like, I'm really homing in on the fact that you said all of these no's, we're actually learning something from them. Because most of the time there's a long email that accompanies it that's telling you why it's a no.
Yeah.
Are there any examples you can think of, or like themes that you pulled out that you then were like, oh, okay, I actually didn't see this before. Just I'm curious if we can like press on that a little bit.
Yeah. So when we originally went out to the market, our product was fully focused on investing. So
yeah,
you linked your bank and brokerage accounts. You were able to see your annual return. You were able to create groups of people and track your return versus them, or follow individuals. And that was like the core of the platform. And a big learning that we heard from a lot of investors was we think that there needs to be more in the cycle. Like,
more in the cycle.
Okay. You have this journey and it's like you figure out, okay, this is what someone's doing. It's like, well, now what? Mm-hmm. Like, now how do they learn from that?
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, how do they then have a conversation on the platform? How do they create community, which is part of why we're doing mm-hmm. different events? What if someone, you know, is already not investing? Like, how do you get that person also on the platform? So how do you help them figure out it is the right time to invest? So there were, you know, some investors that got really into the product with us, which was awesome.
Yeah.
And that was, you know, we were already getting some of that feedback. So it was a time where we're like, all right, let's, you know, go back to some of the initial research we've gotten and like relook at that. I would say the biggest thing that we've heard from investors is the fear of customer acquisition.
Okay.
Because customer acquisition costs in consumer fintech are so high. They can be in the hundreds. And when you are a pre-seed seed company, you don't have hundreds to spend. And so figuring out how are we going to get this product in front of our target audience in a really cheap way was something that we, you know, needed to sit down and like really create a plan around.
Mm-hmm.
Katie, you were telling me earlier about like a flop experience that you've had yourself.
Oh boy.
Can you share, if you're willing to, I'm like putting you on the spot here, but can you share this?
Well, I love that you're focusing on the learnings. I think I also took a big learning from mine. Mine was very recent.
Yeah.
So
fresh.
I basically had the opportunity to interview this person that I really respect, and they're like Pulitzer Prize winning. Like they're like respected in all the ways that I someday want to be respected, you know, like working on very important things and like, sorry,
you will be.
Oh, Linz, love you. No, but like, you know, working on really important things, very accomplished as a writer, just like they were that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we had this interview planned. I like did a lot of research before the interview to just make sure that all the questions I was going to ask them were really, really spot on and like really indicated that like I was familiar with their work and respected their work. And so I'm excited for this interview. So I send the production document ahead of time and I say, okay, so what we're going to talk about, like, I'm so excited to talk to you. And they noted one line that I had written in the beginning of the production document that effectively admitted that like I had not, their book was on my list, but I had not read it yet.
You did all this research, but you just didn't read the book.
I had not read the book.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm not sure if it came across that I had done other research or if they just saw that line and were like, wait a second. And so they initially, like an hour before the interview, they're like, hey, wait, so like you haven't even read my book. And I was like, oh my gosh, Mm-hmm. I was just trying to set the stage. Like, I hadn't read it yet because I had just learned about it more recently. Like, that was the only reason. So it was, like, a big miscommunication in how I had, like, conveyed. But I think they took it as a sign of disrespect. And we kind of went back and forth a little bit. And they were like, I just don't think this interview is a good fit. So I'm, like, kicking myself after the fact. Because I'm like, now we – not only have I, like, insulted this person that I massively respect completely inadvertently – but also now we have to I've inconvenienced my whole team because now we have to like either find someone else to interview or like, you know, we now have to reschedule this episode and like make a new plan for this episode because this person is no longer going to be with us anymore. And I was just really it sucked on multiple levels. And it did ultimately come to the conclusion where like I was apologizing profusely and they're like, it's OK, it's OK. So like, me and this individual are fine. We don't have, like, beef now. But it was just a moment of, like, the learning that I took from that was that you have to be very, very careful about moments where transparency or frankness might come across as, like you just don't know how someone is going to perceive these things, particularly in these interview situations where, like, you are, for all intents and purposes, spotlighting them and their work. Like, I will never write an introduction in one draft ever again. You know what I mean? I was just like, okay, but it's a good learning experience. It's I'm happy that it happened now and that like I've now gone through that, but it was mortifying.
But you know what I hear when I hear that story? Like, that story sounds like right now you told it as a flop story. But I can also imagine that being the start of a story you tell about how you just, like, significantly right after that skyrocketed all of the amazing interviewees. Like, you got even, like, higher. Like, now I'm on this world stage. Like, that sounds like the intro to, like, this crazy success story. And so this is why I'm saying there's, like, these, like, there's a win duality version and there's the flop version of every story. Like, Steve Jobs got kicked out of his company, right? He started Apple. They kick him out. Yeah. He starts another company. He started Pixar.
No, it was a different company. It was, oh my gosh.
Next. We all thought of it at the same time. Next. And then, like, they beg him to come back, right? You could tell that story as that I flopped and got kicked out. Or you could tell that story as, like, a full circle, like, oh, you needed me.
Yeah. You know how I love to do that, too, is in my head. Y'all listen to How I Built This with Guy Raz. You know how he always gets founders talking about their flops? I will sometimes put myself in that imaginary interview situation to reframe the moment in the moment. I'll go, yeah, well, you know, this happened, and I felt terrible, but it taught me that this, and so then what happened next was kind of to your point about it's the beginning of the story. We'll reframe it in the moment to almost talk about it like it happened in the past. It's like a weird little mental hack, but I'm so used to listening to those interviews that that's like the narrative arc that my brain will take
that's
now.
That's an amazing arc
because
to
of
have.
That, and it's in the moment, though, I'm like, with someone on the other end of it whose feelings I just hurt, I'm like, oh my God, cry. Like,
of course.
Weep segment. It was, it was gnarly. We'll be right back to the conversation after a quick break. Okay, back to the show.
Sometimes we feel like obligated, though. I think, like, as women, we feel like more likely to be sort of like apologetic about a thing. Just like, I think we're just like socially conditioned that way. And so we feel like, oh, I've got to like tell the flop version of the story, like the like, oh no, I could reframe it and like still tell that part, but like share it as a win and position as a win, like, is hard for us. So I'm curious, Lindsay, like, do you feel personally the obligation to tell stories as flop stories or as flop then win stories?
I think when you want to be real and authentic, which I feel like that word is said so much, but if you just want to be honest about what you're going through, like, starting a company is a roller coaster. If I just sat here and I was like, it is so fun, it is so rewarding, every day is like yesterday, like, it's not true, you know?
It's a lie. You're so, like, actually, I'm getting beat up over
here. And so when people ask you, it is an interesting balance because you don't want to just be talking about the good things, which there are so many. You don't want to just be talking about the bad things because then people, like, there was one period where people are like, why are you doing this if all this stuff is happening?
And you demotivate your whole team if all you talk about is the bad things. They start to get,
but,
like,
you also want to be transparent with everyone. And so I think for me and for our team, it's definitely a balance of how do we be real about what we're going through and what's great, but also, you know, what's hard. And that way no one's caught off guard. So, like, when we were going through struggles with fundraising, there was, you know, a few months where I said to our engineers, like, we're going to do a little bit of pivoting. Like, if you guys can be on hold right now, we're not going to be building. And they knew we were fundraising. Like, they knew what we were going through, so it wasn't as big of a surprise as it would have been.
Yeah.
I mean, no matter what, that conversation is hard.
Yeah.
But I think it's a balance.
They were along for the ride.
Yeah.
I want to ask you about hiring, too, because you have done something that has been kind of amazing to watch from the outside looking in. I think we could all learn from it. You have gotten such impressive talent, and you're not working with millions of dollars you can throw at these people.
No.
I would love to hear your approach to this.
My personal belief is if you can hire someone that someone you know has worked with before, it always makes it easier.
Yeah.
Okay. There is so much that you can figure out in an interview, but it only goes so far.
Mm-hmm.
So most of our team has been built from a connection of a connection.
Gotcha.
So
okay.
When I started Aster, I had met a designer at my previous company. And I called him up. I was like, I have this idea. Like, start working with me. This was before we had any funding. He's still with us today. He runs our design. And he is in Poland. He had been doing design for 15 years.
Wow.
And we started building. When it came time to hire engineers, he was like, I have this army of engineers I've worked with that I think are awesome. Like, connected me to them, got on the phone with them. And that's kind of how everything moved from one step to the next. So for us, it was really, how do you use your network to hire? And then what are the core things that you look for in those interviews? And I think the one thing that is really important to me, especially at this stage, is passionate about the problem we're solving and passionate about building something from zero to one. And as long as I can find someone with that energy, that drive, that excitement, I know that they're going to be a good fit for our team.
Mm-hmm. How big is your team right now?
There are three of us full-time.
Beautiful.
And then we have, it ranges depending on the month, but about four or five contractors.
Yeah. Okay, good. Got it. Okay. I was asking that because I think, like, once a company starts to get to a certain size, too, we're just talking about, like, sharing the transparency of everything. There are some people who can really handle knowing all of the highs and lows. Are kind of like, maybe they're not the entrepreneur themselves or the co-founder themselves, but they're like, if you join a team with three people, you know what you're signing yourself up for, right?
Totally.
And then you should. You're right. Yes, correct. Maybe you don't, though. Maybe it's your first time. Like, we're all figuring it out as we go.
Yeah.
But I do think there's sometimes people who are on your team who maybe cannot handle that kind of high and low with you and start to feel demotivated around it. And so, like, I hear a lot of my founder friends, like, talking about, like, how much transparency is too much, too little, just, like, navigating.
Which is real.
Yeah.
Because I think as the CEO, it's on you to wear that. Like, you...
Yeah.
You are the one who should wear that anxiety and that worry.
Yeah.
And being transparent with your team is important, but if everyone is wearing that, I don't know that it's productive.
No one gets anything done, and then it starts to, like, spread like a cancer through the organization, and everybody's demotivated, which is, like, that does nothing.
No.
So you kind of have to hold, some of it you just hold yourself and, like, cry on the pillow.
Exactly. Yeah. To your friends.
Keep it to yourself.
To your parents.
Yeah.
To whoever it is.
Not at the company. Hang.
Yeah.
It's a responsibility.
Yeah. Thanks for sharing that, too, because I think it's just been – you've also gotten people from other big fintech companies, which has been interesting to watch, that you're able to lure these people away with your vision, which I think is why I am confident that you're going to succeed in this.
Thank you.
Is because you are getting – you're making the right calls. Like, you're getting these very talented people from companies that – big name unicorn companies that have done this before, that have pulled this off. Like, it's really, really inspiring to see. So I know that it's it is a roller coaster, but that feels like a high point from the outside looking in.
Definitely. No, I think most of the moments are highs. Like, you are building something every day. You're seeing reward. Like, you see people using it. You see people getting joy out of what you want them to be getting joy out of. And so there's so many high moments, but it's a roller coaster for sure.
One of the things we talk a lot about on this show are, like, muses or, like, people that you look to and you're like, I love how they do that. I love how they handle this. Like, I would like to be able to handle things similarly. Are there any people in your life, and this is for like both of you, we can sort of like collectively talk about this, like people in your life who you're like, oh dang, I like how they handle things, the highs and the lows.
Katie, you kick us off here.
Okay.
We do like a thinking moment.
I like how they handle the highs and the lows.
Yeah.
This might be a bit of a cheating answer, but I do think you're somebody like that for me, because I do watch you navigate some of this stuff, and we've had very frank conversations about like what needs to happen in the next 6 months in order for you guys to get more runway and keep going. Mm-hmm. And it's like, sometimes I don't think I fully grasped how do or die it can be when you are like the end of the runway is over there, and there is a timeline that we're going to hit that in. And like, if these things don't happen before then, we're done.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
But when I said I've never seen you be rankled, I mean, like, that's a very high stress situation. And I think you do a good job of keeping a solid baseline. So I'm actually kind of I'm glad you're here, that you're my example, because I'm like, how do you think you do that?
I think a lot of it comes from learning.
Okay.
So the first time you go through, okay, we are running out of runway.
Yeah. And by runway, we mean money.
We are running out of money to pay the team.
Yeah.
And we need this money. I think I definitely wasn't as calm as I will be the next time we face that.
Yeah.
And so I think a lot of it is muscle memory. Like everything feels like the biggest deal the first time you do it. Like the first time you have to fire someone, the first time you're running out of money. It's like, oh my gosh, it's like I'm breaking up with, you know, my partner. It's everything is so big in the beginning.
Yeah.
And then you do it once and you're like, okay, the world didn't end.
Yeah.
And then when the world doesn't end, you're like, you look back and you're like, I wish I didn't bring myself on that roller coaster. Like how could I have been, you know, more calm throughout that journey, because the world didn't end.
The roller coaster is optional.
It is.
It is
optional. It doesn't always feel that way, but it is.
It really is.
You can step right off of it.
You could step off of it. You'd be like, let me off the ride. But I want, if people are just listening to this and they're not watching it either on Spotify, you can watch it, and also on YouTube, I'd love for you guys to see Lindsay's like poisonous. Like she's, I would say,
right?
Cool is the
that's
word.
That's the word.
Cool
yes.
is the word I would use to describe. And I don't even, I mean, cool, like you are cool, but there's like a coolness,
like cucumber
a calm,
cool.
Like cool, like a cucumberness about you that is very CEO like.
Thank you. I don't think there are definitely moments. So like this week, you know, we launched our product yesterday, join our waitlist, download our app.
Yes.
And there were moments where we were finding little things. And if you saw me on calls with my team, you might not have saw that same cool behavior.
It's a bug. There's a bug.
Yeah, but but I think intensity is necessary in this role.
Yeah.
But being level-headed is the most important.
Yeah, that's the interesting balance, right? Because you really have to infuse your team with energy.
Yeah.
That energy comes from you. Definitely. And also, you got to be super calm so you don't panic everyone. And, like, when do you do each one? Like, you've got this good balance of this, which is impressive.
I'm working on it.
Yeah. Katie asked you when she was like, how do you do it? And I was curious, do you feel like you do it?
Oh, that's a good question.
I don't think walking in here, I would have ever said I was like calm, cool, and collected.
Really?
Yeah. It's giving I'm unbothered energy.
No, no, no.
Poise is the perfect word.
Poise.
It really is.
But you don't necessarily feel that way. On a scale of 1 to 10, how poised do you feel like you are?
5.
Okay.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Then I'm a -3.
No, not at all.
If you're a 5, I'm in the negatives.
Oh my God. I think we're always our toughest critic, right?
Definitely. We film this show in batches, so we do like multiple in a day. And I had a conversation the other day with Katie about this, because between a meeting, I had to let someone go. And I came back and Katie was like, what? You just did that just now? Like, and I was very calm about it because like I got enough reps in.
Yeah.
That like, and I panicked about it enough.
Yep.
And like I freaked out about it enough that like I now that similar insight that you just said about like, oh, why was I tripping about that? Like it was okay. That person was like, actually, like I saw this coming. Like I think, you know, like maybe it isn't working. Like, and I'm like, okay, great. Like, but I think you're a really great person. I want to help you find the next thing. Yeah. And they're like, thank you so much. And it was good vibes. And so after I had enough experiences like that and learned how to do it, I was like, oh, okay. Like I don't need to be freaked out every single time. But at the beginning, you freaked out every time
all
something
time.
Goes wrong.
I do want to just shout out to that piece you just said about I knew this was coming. Anyone who's like, how would they know? The scorecard episode is like, I think, such a good listen if you haven't heard that one yet, because it's a I think the reason this person knew it was coming is because you had predetermined and quantified what success looked like, and success had not been happening.
Yeah.
So it's like it wasn't a surprise. Mm.
Someone said to me, I don't remember who gave me this advice, so like shout out to whoever did, but they were like, if you let someone go and it was a surprise to them, that's your fault.
Yes.
Exactly. I love that advice.
Poor management on your end. You didn't give them any feedback. You didn't give them the opportunity to shift it. And sometimes, like when I was starting entrepreneurship, I'd be so shy about giving feedback.
Yeah.
And I couldn't hit someone straight with like, let me tell you a couple things that are working. Let me tell you a couple things that are not working. I just couldn't hit the feedback in. Mm-hmm. And like, I could see how people were just floundering and like I was making people's job harder because I couldn't hit them straight with feedback because I was scared. Yeah. And so I had to like grow out of that. So now if we have to transition something, and that could be your moment of like, we're running out of money. That could be a transition. The other transition could be like the performance wise, like you're not performing well. Either way, I should like let you in on some context of that. And the more senior the person is, like closer to working with me, the more I think that's important.
Yeah.
I like that.
What is your feedback style?
Ooh, what is my feedback style? I'm now pretty direct. I do the like superpower kryptonite framework. Mm-hmm. So I hit them with a couple things I love that they do first. Mm-hmm. And then I share some feedback with them. Now, I would say with my friends, because my friends and I are really good at giving each other feedback, we just go straight to it. So my friends would be like, can I tell you something I'm seeing right now? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, what? Fine, hold on, let me get myself ready. What? And then but I know they're gonna say something really insightful and like, I see like you're in a little bit of a limiting belief right now. Mm-hmm. Like, here's what I'm like, there's a voice in your head, and like as my friend Rachel says, like, and I want to smack her because like she's like off track right here. Like, maybe think, and I know to take that feedback on and be like, even if it doesn't resonate, I go like, okay, let me sit with that.
Yeah.
Mm.
When it's my team, I am, so that's how I like am back and forth with my friends. With my team, I'm pretty straightforward on like saying, here's what I think is maybe not working. Mm-hmm. But I wasn't when I started.
Yeah.
It was messy, and like I would say like something on the side of, this is like my pet peeve now, when someone says something on the side of the feedback instead of right on the feedback, because it results in like, if someone's messing up and they say the feedback on the side, so the person doesn't get the feedback. Mm-hmm. They just keep flopping.
Yep.
Like,
yep.
They had a flop, and then you just let them keep flopping because they didn't understand the feedback because you were being, like, tiptoeing around it.
Yeah, so, just let them keep flopping.
You let that person flop.
Totally. I want to introduce an external piece to this conversation.
Okay,
which is a little listener question that I want y'all's feedback on.
Okay.
I have some thoughts, but I'd like to hear from you guys first. The question is, and I'm going to include the praise because that's my love language, is words of affirmation. So I'm loving this show so much. Thank you. Me too. Feel like I've been brainstorming a brand and business for years, but I've been so stuck in getting started. I'd love to hear some about the early, early days of transitioning ideas into starting something tangible, going from an audience zero to even just 1,000. So I'm going to assume audience that this is someone that's like thinking about like content creation.
Mm-hmm.
But we should broaden just in case, because that's not the situation everyone's going to be in. I feel paralyzed not having it all planned out. Mm. I know what you're going to say.
I'm going to be quiet.
So let me go, Lindsay.
Okay. I wonder if we're going
to
say the same thing.
The paralysis of feeling like it's not all planned out. I don't know how to start. It's the first. I'm at zero. How do I get to one?
I don't think you can have it planned out, because if it's all planned out, it's all your bias. So whoever this is, I would
say they were anonymous. They were
anonymous person. You need to do your research. So I think like you start with an idea, whether it's in the content space, like what is the niche that you're going to solve or be a part of? If it's a product, like what is your hypothesis? And then you have to do your research. Mm-hmm. I think the most important thing is getting in front of your potential customers and learning from them. Yeah. And then from there, you figure out, like, do I have enough to start building, or do I need to keep doing research? So I think for me, like, the most important thing this person has to do is their research.
And do you consider getting in front of customers to be research, or that's something different?
That is exactly what I think.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That is the research.
So talk to people.
So I think
you need more information.
Yeah, I think you have to do market research to figure out, like, okay, does, like, the market align with what I think this problem is? But then you have to actually speak to customers and see what they're saying and see what they're feeling, because there's so much you can read that doesn't actually translate to the world. And so for us, we've spoken to thousands of people about how they manage their money. And the takeaways we have, we would have never found from just reading, or it's so different from what we originally wanted to start out as. So I think spending time, like, as much as you need, talking to people and learning about the space and learning the pain points, that's free. Like, you can find people in many different ways.
How do you find them? Like, if you're going to talk to, you said customers, but it could be customers, or if you don't have any customers, potential customers, like ideal customers, but maybe ideal they're not a customer yet. But, like, how do you find them?
I think it depends on the space you're in, but you kind of just need to, like, reach out to people cold in the beginning. So if there's something you're building for, like, who is that target persona? You find that target persona through social media, through your networks, whatever it is.
Or go where they are.
Yeah.
Like, I'm immediately imagining, like, I'm picking a manufacturing product because I think digital is too, I'm trying to put myself in a different set of shoes. But, like, if I'm trying to develop a skincare product, maybe I'm going to go to Sephora and Target. Yes. And, like, stand in the skincare section and, like, observe
what people are doing.
How people, and be like, hey, I noticed you're, like, looking at that. Like, have you ever used it before? What do you think about it? Like, go to where those people are.
Yeah.
That would be my first instinct.
And then, like, cold email someone who writes a skincare blog and talk to them about what they're hearing. There's so many people that you can reach out to that have spoken to your customer. And so
I love that. That's a good. I also have an experience with that that I want to share because it might be helpful.
Yeah.
When I was trying to figure out how to launch a course, one of the things that I did was some ideal client research around, like, who do I think needs this help and who am I trying to reach? And to your point, Tara, always about basically, like, if you want to target people that have a high willingness to spend.
Yeah.
High willingness to transact. They've got a lot of money to spend, and, you know, what is their problem?
Particularly at the beginning when you're starting
particularly
something.
Particularly at the beginning when you're trying to, you know, you need to find people that are willing to spend money on something. I had this theory that, like, there might be a lot of people out there that are making a lot of money and have no idea what to do with it, just because I had heard that from people that read my posts and podcast. And so I interviewed a friend who was making a lot of money, a lot of money. And I was kind of like, my assumption is that this person, because they're so smart and they're so savvy and they have all this money, that they already know what they're doing with it. And when I interviewed her, she was like, oh, no, I just have, like, hundreds of thousands of dollars in a savings account. I'm like, no, I have no idea what to do with it. And it was this huge unlock. And so when we did, like, usability research or user research for when I was a content designer, like a user experience writer, we would only ever talk to five people. We would get the product in front of five people and have them go through it. And those five people, that was kind of like the magic number in you know, just like usability testing, where you're trying to, you know, it's not a big thing, but you're trying to get initial feedback. And that's kind of like the sweet spot where, like, you're going to hear themes if you're talking to five people, which is a really interesting piece of that field that I was like, that kind of surprised me. But I don't think that you have to talk to, it's not like you got to go talk to thousands of people.
No,
you know what I mean? It can be a handful, and you're probably going to immediately start to notice the trends.
Yeah.
And when you're having those conversations, one other great piece of advice I was given is, at the end of that first conversation, ask that person, is there someone else you know who's dealing with something similar? And have them connect you. And that's an amazing way to keep doing research.
I also love the question, is this something you're willing to pay for? 100%. Can I get you signed up?
Yeah.
Because those customer interview questions, like, I always, like, see people in a customer interview and they're, like, getting all this feedback and the person's like, yeah, they're excited. And I'm like, why are you not selling? Why are you not getting that one sign up right now?
Yeah.
And so there's an opportunity to sell. Like, actually, in the question that was written into us, it says going from an audience to zero to even to 1,000. And Katie assumed it was a content business. I hope it's a content business, because if it's not, we don't need audience. We need customers.
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah.
Not audience.
That's
and so
true.
Thinking about it, maybe that shift, and you just need to start getting, get one to start.
That's all. Let's make the implicit more explicit there.
Yeah.
If you're talking, if the person who wrote this in, or who maybe, like, or someone listening to this is thinking about it like audience, you're thinking about marketing when, as we've said in the past, you should be thinking about sales. If this is not content creation, it's not audience.
Yeah.
It's not marketing. It's not positioning. It's selling.
Even sometimes when the business is a marketing related, like content related business, like I think even in your scenario where like you need, maybe it's not like a super high price point for the app use or the download, you might need at the beginning, like I'm going to do a version of the product that's a little bit more hands-on that we start like to charge a high ticket price for so we can get people on board and like really hands-on and doing something in detail and also get some money on board. And then we're going to expand it to something that's more content based or something more like low price point based, so that you can get some revenue, show the traction, like get things going.
I'm curious, Tara, if you got any mindset thoughts here, because it seems to me like the analysis paralysis of being stuck in the idea phase is a mindset thing, and I feel like you have you probably have a perspective.
You might not like it. I think this just like needs a courage sprint. Like I do not have it figured out either. None of us do. So if you're waiting to like feel like it's figured out to start, like you're, that's not the game of entrepreneurship. Go do something else then, if that's what you're looking for. And so I think though, the way you do it is you go, I'm about to do something. I have no idea if it's going to work. I'm going to allot an hour and I'm going to do all the things that Lindsay just said about like reaching out to people, like having those conversations. This is my hour where I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. And I don't get to second guess or judge it. And like, once you do that a couple times, you're like, all right, like I'm going to just get the work done and like you'll get into the role of it. But like maybe crafting out these periods of time where you get to just like turn off all second guesses, all analysis paralysis, because like businesses start by you doing stuff.
Mm-hmm. And that courage sprint that Tara's talking about for the audience, we did an entire episode about this type of like confidence building courage sprint with Rachel Rogers. So if you've not heard that one yet, that's a good one to listen
to. Either it's already out or it's coming.
Yes.
We'll see.
If you want to dive deeper, if you want to dive deeper, that's a good one.
Perfect. Well, I think this is a good place to wrap up our conversation. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you guys for having me. This
and
was
for
fun.
Gracing our fun couch.
And being vulnerable with us about like the highs and the lows.
Always.
Yeah. Truly.
Thank you guys.
Thank you.
Take your business further with the smart and flexible American Express Business Gold Card. It's packed with benefits to help unlock more value from your business purchases. That's the powerful backing of American Express. Learn more at americanexpress.com/businessgoldcard.